Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, once again, Blog Talk Radio, and this is Russell, and we will be talking about many subject matters today. One of the things I want to talk about is disclosure, just a wee bit, and what's coming down to the planet of so that things will be changing. Jillian is with us once again. I really appreciate her being on, so we won't be a long time today. But we want to talk about disclosure because it's all over television. And, you know, the UFOs, Pentagon, et cetera, et cetera. Here's an opening.
Military official who ran the covert government program up until this last November, Luis Elizondo. Luis, thank you so much for your time tonight. I mean, first, tell us what the purpose of the program was and why it was so secretive.
Sure. The purpose of the program, Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, was really designed to do just that. From a national security perspective, identify those things that we see, whether we see them electro-optically, we see them with radar, we see them as eyewitness reports, through a myriad of different ways and avenues that we receive the information, and try to ascertain and determine if that information is a potential threat to national security, in a nutshell.
Okay. Yeah, that's the talking. Those are the talking points. So, what do you think? I mean, you've been around the industry a long time, and so George Green, I think he was in research of this thing 50, 60 years, maybe more. Right. Now, the Pentagon is, but before now, when you say Area 51, S4, Groom's Lake, or anything about UFOs or something, AUPs, now they call them. There was always a denial. No, you guys are smoking something. You don't know what you're talking about. Why do you think now, 2022, we are talking about disclosure at last?
Well, I think there are probably two reasons. One, because the extraterrestrials with whom they are working are themselves ready to step forward and do to or with the planet whatever they think they want to do and they think they can get away with. And secondly, that more than 50% of the world's population now accept that there are probably extraterrestrials and that they haven't interacted. In other words, it's no longer a secret. The majority of people today actually do accept the possibility of extraterrestrials in the universe. Even the Pope came out and told the Catholics that they should all believe, you know, that there probably were other people in the universe. So this being the case, I don't think that they any longer have the ability to hide these things from the public. This is not just about the extraterrestrials. This is about everything. It's almost as if in the last, let's say, 20 years, since 2000, say, the human race has grown up. We have now, as a species, become adults. We're no longer in the children's room, and we're not going to be talked down to as children any longer. We're going to hold those in office all around the world accountable for their behavior. And we're going to demand to know what's going on. So I really don't think that the governments of the world can hide this for much longer.
Okay, well, it's interesting that, you're probably right. I mean, when George was here, I mean, he just crossed over a couple of years ago. It was more than, 50 years? He was doing research, traveling all over the world, meeting Billy Myers and Wendell Stevens and all the rest of the people that he came in contact with in the government and outside of the government. So now all of his work is coming to fruition, I guess. The disclosure that he talked about. Okay. How would he feel now? How would he feel if he were here?
Well, I think he would be giving a sigh of relief to say, maybe now you will believe me. But also a great sense of disappointment because it wasn't 50 or 60 years. It was certainly at least 30 years, the last 30 years of his life, that he was involved with this. And his involvement was not just with the extraterrestrials, but it was as much with the governments and government behavior around the world. So his goal from day one was to wake people up to their responsibilities, to say, you know, nobody's coming to save you. The ETs are not going to send UFOs to take you off the planet when you wreck it or when you explode nuclear bomb and make the place uninhabitable. Nobody will come and rescue you. So you need to clean up your act. Now you need to start becoming responsible for yourselves as individuals. And of course, this always paralleled the work I was doing, because I was doing the same thing, but about the spiritual need to be responsible. So when you combine the two things together, we will both take responsibility as an individual. Well, I think that's what's happening. I think that finally people have woken up to a very large degree and are now saying, yes, I'm being responsible because I'm now searching for information. I'm not just believing everything that they spoon feed me with. I'm actually asking questions. And that means that they have woken up. And so yeah. I think George, if he was here, he'd be very happy with that.
Yeah,
very
a lot of people
to think his work was bearing fruit.
Right, right. That's true. That's true. Yeah, because I got recordings of him back in 92 when I was the last time I interviewed him, I think. I might have interviewed him after that, but that was in Baltimore. Yeah, so people are beginning to awaken to the fact that there are possibilities. Do you think it's because of the James Webb telescope, that new one that's monumental, or the Hubble telescope, or astronauts going to the moon, coming back, and eventually Buzz Aldrin and others giving reports on the side saying, hey, we were quiet for a while, but now, I'm still thinking too, but Colonel Corso, the day after Roswell, that book, that finally he passed a couple of years ago, and he left a book, and he said for the last 30, 40 years that I have been holding the secrets in tow, just keeping it close to my chest, and now I'm leaving the planet, and here's what I've been doing. Have you read the book, The Day After Roswell?
No, okay. I haven't. But I know you've spoken about it several times. But I'm not familiar with it. But I think that's what has happened to a large degree, that all those old school people who were in on the secrets, so to speak, were bound, the ones that were at high government level and were actually knowledgeable in a very real sense, were bound to secrecy. They weren't allowed to tell what they knew. And I think it was threat of their families and, you know, the destruction of their lives, really, if they did speak out. So it seems hard now to imagine that a government in the United States would be such that they would threaten a man's family to kill them, literally, take them out, if that man ever spoke the truth of what he knew. I mean, that's, considering the First Amendment is about free speech, that doesn't sound very much like free speech. But this is what happens. This is what has always happened in this country and around the world. America is not alone in this. Governments always bind people to secrets, and they threaten their families with destruction if they break their oath. That's why they have to sign all these papers, you know, non-disclosure papers. So it's not surprising that now that these older generation are dying off, we are finally getting from them the truth before they die. They're going to tell the truth because they don't care anymore.
Right.
So, yes, we can believe these people. But more than that, I think we have also had a generation that has born and grown up. I mean, you think of anybody almost under 40 today, they grew up in an age where people had been to the moon, right? Even 50, 60, right? The two could be two, maybe even three generations on the planet now, if you look at the really young kids, who have always known that we could put rockets on the moon, have always had pictures of Mars on their television screens, and have never been without that kind of access to that kind of spatial information about the universe and the possibilities out there. So to younger people, the idea of extraterrestrials is not a strange idea. It's a reasonable and normal idea. And when you consider that at the same time as this kind of information was out there in the public, you know, photographs of Mars and the photographs from Voyager and all these wonderful pictures that NASA puts out on the TV, on their program, that have been available for years. And at the same time, in that same quarter century, the churches around the world, no matter what, I want to say the religions around the world, were losing membership massively. In other words, at the same time as people were being exposed to the possibilities of the universe, their religious beliefs were also getting fractured or torn down even in some cases, and they were starting to ask questions. And of course, we all know the advancement in any level is through the questions we ask. You know, a child in school is an intelligent child when their hand up is asking the teacher questions all the time. Well, it's the same for the human race. And in the last quarter century, especially among the young people, they've started asking questions. And they've been asking a lot of the right questions. Of course, some of them have asked the wrong questions as well, but the majority of them. And this is why I think humankind across the board is taking a huge leap forward in this very time in history, that we have got a mass, when you have more than you need to do something in energy, right? Right now we have an energetic mass among humans on this belief is really going to carry them forward totally in their experience of life into all the right. future.
So as we talk about all the disclosure now, there's, may I say, a ton of information, because now we have to go back and get all that information that has been hidden. People on Mars now, the United States as well as some other countries have put people on Mars. We are talking about the underground bases, especially in Antarctica, right? Dorsey, we talked about that a bit. So there are entities not only from other planets, but there are entities living in the hollow cones or the hollowness of this planet, right? So, I mean, in the Catholic Church, they didn't see that picture that I just painted like that. And that not just one species, the grays and the reptilians and the tall whites and the Nordics and reptilians and on and on and on, right? So now all of that information has to come to the fore, and people have to massage that and take that in. Let me do this.
Yes.
His Laura Eisenhower, she talked about, she's been working on it at least 30 years, and that she's the great-great-great-granddaughter of President Eisenhower.
Understanding of really what this positive timeline really means. And it's not just like some timeline we stumble upon and we get lucky. It's who we really are and the path we've always been walking. And so these agendas, through fear, have tried to steer us away from that, because through fear, we give our power away, we buy into the money system, and we look outside of ourselves. And that's not liberation. Liberation is understanding what we're made of on the inside and activating those abilities through being highly conscious in every moment. You know, understanding that every moment is sacred. The words that we use, the way we treat each other, the food we put into our body, the lifestyles that we lead, I mean, that all, you know, comes down to it. And when we start to do things on our own terms, and we start to recognize that we do have free will, and only they can manipulate us out of that, they can't actually take it, then what is there to fear anymore? Because it's not about fearing death. We know we've died before. It's about being very discerning about whether or not we are being controlled. And to really step back and ask ourselves those questions, what is controlling us? What is ruling our moods? How do we feel when we wake up in the morning? What are we passionate about? And what are our excuses for not following our heart and our dreams? And start to look at, okay, well, those are excuses. Those are controls. And we don't have to buy into that. And so it's understandable that people get lost in this stuff, but it's a game. And that game is the same game the negative ego plays with us. And the minute we start to say, you know what, you need to follow the guidance of higher self, then that's when the purification starts to happen. And when each of us does that, in terms of how we relate to how we create abundance and how we take care of our survival space, we can let go of the governments and start to say, wait a second, I have much more trust in the universe and spirit and the God goddess that lives within and everywhere to provide exactly what our needs are. And that's part of the spontaneity of embracing the mystery and also being highly creative in how we set our intentions and how we visualize things that we want to manifest. And then push out all self-doubt, all fear, and everything, what mom has to say, what so-and-so has to say, you know, the projections of, oh, you're crazy, you'll never be able to do that, and just filter it out. It has nothing to do with you. And that's liberation, is to just live your truth and to say, who cares what anybody else thinks, but to at least devote oneself to integrity so that the energy flow is not creating karma and not creating more filth. Because it's not about being selfish. It's about finding balance, understanding unity consciousness, and understanding that this is part of natural law and universal laws, and that we are here as humans to learn how to return to that. And it's not a very easy place to learn, but we have completed a lot of these lessons, and so it's going to be easier more than any other time in our existence to move out of fear, because we're in alignment with the galactic plane right now. Mm-hmm. People are really, really waking up, and it's far easier to be liberated, even if we witness particular scenarios that seem like it's taking us down into doom and gloom. Spirit, you can't trump it. There's nothing more powerful. So we'll never lose connection with it, but the illusion of separation can cause our creative energy to pull us into traps and to take us down roads that will delay us from the inevitable, which is our return home to source.
So she's right on target, isn't she? How do you feel
she
about
is,
the statement?
Absolutely. Pardon?
But you know, you've been teaching this for many years on this planet. I mean, you wrote the book ETA, Return of the Anunnaki, with George. I mean, you traveled, you were clairvoyant. I mean, come on, that's your background to help us.
Yes, it is. It's one of the things that I know about. I love this lady. I love listening to her. And I totally agree with what she's saying. I especially like that she used the word discernment, because that is the key. You know, and our perspective is what really shows where we are and what we're thinking. And we can change our perspective very easily. And I don't disagree with anything that she was saying. But it's also kind of like when I was a student nurse many, many years ago, we went over into the schoolroom and they had it set up like a ward that we were going to work on, you know, with a bed and a dummy patient in the bed and all the instruments and things laid around. And everything in there was perfect. So when we made the bed in there, it was perfect. When we used the instruments, they were perfect. When we laid the patient down, the patient laid down perfectly. Everything in the schoolroom was perfect. And the goal was to translate that level of perfection to the work that we did on the wards, right? But like any plan, as soon as you put it into action, it starts to fall apart, because then you run into the problems that are real, the problems that exist. And so what the young lady, Ms. Eisenhower, was talking about then was like that schoolroom. She was talking about a level of perfection that I think few of us ever achieve. It should be our goal. It should be what we're aiming for. But real life gets in the way of it far too often. And so for anybody listening to that and then looking at their own lives and where they are at this point in their lives, I think that many would just give up. They would say, well, I can't be like that. I can't live in that moment. I can't do as I like and not care what other people think. And that's true. Most people are not in a position to live what we would consider to be a perfect life spiritually. And it takes a great deal of effort and much practice, plus support of people around you, to actually get your life to the point where you can live like that within the middle of your family and your community and your friends, incorporating them. Because the chances of every single person in any family group or any workplace all being at exactly the same high level of spirituality is very, very unlikely, unless you actually go and live in a monastery where everybody is striving for the same spiritual awareness every single day. It's not going to happen. You're on your own. And so when you are facing with all the issues that are around you from other people that are not on the same wavelength as you, then it becomes a real struggle. So I want to just stress with anybody who listens to what that young lady was saying, and I totally agree with her, and then looks at themselves, don't be discouraged, because here's the thing. When it comes to the final analysis of will you get a chance to move forward into a higher expression of life, or will you be left behind because you, quote, weren't quite good enough, the truth of the matter is that you only have to be trying. If spirit sees that you are trying, that you are making the attempt, you don't have to get it perfect. You just have to be trying to get it perfect. You don't have to be able to do everything. What you have to be able to do is understand what it is you are trying to do. So I would suggest to anybody, take all those pieces that Ms. Eisenhower is suggesting that one needs to do spiritually, and make sure that you understand what it is she's saying. Make sure that you understand how it is to live in the moment, or in a sacred space, or without caring what other people think, or without having too attachment to your material possessions. And I want to say right here, there is absolutely no reason why every single person in the world couldn't be a multimillionaire. From a spiritual point of view, having wonderful possessions is not unspiritual. It's only when the things own you rather than you owning them, when you become so attached to them that you can't let them go. That's the problem. Not having the things to use, but be unwilling to let them go. Attachment. Attachment on all levels. Your mental attachment to your knowledge, all your emotional attachments, your physical attachments to your material goods, and the mental attachment that some people have to their spiritual journey, that they think that they can't be living perfectly happily on this planet unless they're doing something wonderfully spiritual every day, right? It's like, oh my heavens, we don't all live on top of a mountain all the time. We live in this real world, and here down in the ditches, it's muddy and it's dirty, and we have to get our hands dirty to get through life. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. That's where we learn the great lesson of all, which is the lesson of humility. As soon as we see ourselves on a super spiritual path that makes us somehow better than everybody else, we've lost the game then. That's a no-go. Okay. We are never better than anybody else.
Okay, would you say the book that you went over a couple of weeks ago, Saving Jesus, would you say that's a must for people to read and go through Go ahead.
If anybody in this time in history, if anybody wants the shortest cut I have ever seen to your spiritual evolution, to fulfilling Christ's admonition to be in the world but not of the world, and to fulfill his endowment, which was everything I do, you can do and more. If you want the shortest cut I've seen to reaching that point, then read that book, Saving Jesus, and read it with the intention of understanding it and working through it. Read it without judgment and without criticism of any kind. Read it. Go through it. you will find at the end that essentially it will make you a new person within yourself. It's the most enlightening book I've ever read. It's an incredible book.
As a clairvoyant, were you teaching meditation to people?
I taught them how to do it. To be truthful, I don't meditate. I mean, for me, a country walk is a meditation, or weeding the garden is a meditation. I never sit and meditate. So I actually wrote a little book for my students, just a small book with different meditations they could do, because they asked me to. And I showed them the basic thing that you need to do is just put that white light around you and practice emptying your mind. Because once you empty your mind, then that is a state of meditation. And spiritual insight and inspiration can flow into you. For me, though, for starters, I could never sit still long enough to do meditations. I don't have the patience. And the other thing that I found interesting, Russell, now you mentioned meditation, is that people go in groups and somebody leads a meditation. They walk them down a path into wherever, and tell them they can hear birds singing. Well, when you do that kind of meditation, and it's a way of learning how to do it, but when you actually do it like that, and that becomes your practice, you are never, ever meditating, because what you're doing is listening to the person who is leading the meditation. And that prevents you, that listening to her prevents you from listening to spirit. You cannot do meditation with a group of people where somebody is talking. Meditation is a thing of silence, and only silence. No sound should be there at all.
All right. So the book ETA, was that the one you were talking about, the book ETA?
ETA was a little science fiction story that I wrote with my friend Zayada. She and I thought it would be good to put down some information we had about what was coming on the planet, but write it like a little science fiction story, which we did. And that was ETA.
Okay. And that can be found at nohoax.net.
Nohoax.com. Yeah. My name then was not Green. It was D'Armond, Jillian D'Armond. So anything that I'd written is under the name of D'Armond.
And Return of the Anunnaki. That's the other book that's there on No Hoax.
Return of the Anunnaki, Violet Flame, and Other Meditations. That's a little 60-page booklet, really, of different meditations and how to do it, that I did for the classes, and Chalice of the Dove, which is a book about metaphysical information from spirit, things they told me to do.
Yep. When I hear Laura talking, Eisenhower, obviously she's been working on it for the last 3 decades or more. And it's been difficult. It's been challenging. And you are telling us that even to become a better person on planet Earth at this time, 2022, and this is August 6th, it's still going to be a challenge. It'll take work. That's what you're saying.
For all of us.
Okay.
It takes work.
All right. So they should be disappointed slipping back a time or two.
No. Never be disappointed. If you do one step forward and two steps back, that doesn't matter. The fact that you try to take the one step forward, that's what counts. And that's what counts in the final, if you want to say, the final analysis, the evaluation of your soul. Let me give you a clue here. First of all, you're never, ever going to really be capable of judging yourself, because you don't know the whole story. You don't know all that's gone in the lives before, right? So if you're only looking at yourself in this lifetime, don't judge yourself harshly, no matter what kind of a mess you've got in, because it doesn't work that way. Higher beings will make judgment of you at a later date. Now, what I want to say about their kind of judgment is this, and I know this is true. For every single good deed you ever did in any lifetime, you get like a million gold stars. And for every 1,000 things you did wrong in any lifetime, well, most of it they just erase, and you might get one black mark. And the reason for this is because spirit, the energy of spirit off planet, is perfectly well aware of how difficult life is on the planet. We get mad with the guys sometimes, you know, and say, you've forgotten what it's like down here. We've got to deal with this. We've got to deal with that. And we do have a lot to deal with in the material world. And the worst thing we have to deal with is that we're so isolated in our own heads. Sometimes we can feel quite lost. And it surprised me to realize that not everybody was clairvoyant. And to be honest, how people live without being clairvoyant in this world, I don't understand. I don't know how they manage it. To me, they should be given 10,000 gold stars just for existing here, because to actually evaluate everything you do every single day and make the assessment, is this the right thing? Am I doing the right thing? Am I on the right track? Am I moving in the right direction? This is very difficult. It's like we have to keep that at the back of our minds. And so as a clue, let me say this as a clue to guide your life if you don't know where you're going and what you're doing most of the time, like most of us, right? Spirit always says, do what you do for the joy of doing it without any attachment to the outcome. Do what you do for the joy of doing it without any attachment to the outcome. Now, if you can, if anybody's listening to this, if they can write that down on a piece of paper as a reminder to themselves and actually apply that to their lives, they will find that they are on the right track, spiritually speaking, whether they realize it or not. It's a sure way to move yourself forward in the right direction. Because understand what it's saying. The world is full of people doing good to people who don't necessarily want good doing to them. In other words, we all have a tendency to want to be good, because that's the nature of the soul. The soul wants to be good in the truest sense of the word good, right? And so we all instinctively want to be good, and sometimes we perceive that as good intention, meaning doing things for other people. And so that may benefit the other people, but if we do it with the intention of benefiting ourselves in any way, it's not going to do us any good at all, spiritually speaking. And in fact, it might be damaging to the people we're doing it to, because we haven't asked them if it's what they want. So another guiding thing to remember, if people are struggling and want to get ahead spiritually, spiritual life is really so simple. If you follow these few guidelines, it's really pretty easy to see whether you're on a spiritual track or not, meaning whether you're living life appropriately. Another one is just remember what Christ said. If somebody asks you to go a mile, go two. If they ask you for money, give them some. Don't ask for it back, right? Don't be a usurer. In other words, give what is asked of you in this life. But don't be busy determining what other people need. Other people's lives are their lives to live. And when they ask you for help, you do your best to give it. And when you can't give it, you just say, I'm sorry, I can't help you. That's fine. That's fine. You don't have to go around helping everybody all the time, right? But that's the key, give help when it's asked for. I was told a long time ago, stop talking to people about all this metaphysical stuff. Maybe they don't want to hear it. Maybe they don't want to know. Only talk to the people who ask you. If somebody asks you a question, do your best to answer it. But if they don't ask, leave them alone. And that was kind of hard for me because I was used to, you know, expressing it to anybody I could get to listen. It never occurred to me to wait until they asked. But that's what we all need to do. Respond to that of the, that is asked of us.
Is it when the student is ready, the teacher will appear? Exactly.
And it's true. When the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And there is no time in your life, no matter what your situation is, if you've got your earbuds in and the music on the MP3 or whatever they're called, full blast with heavy metal, bombing your brain out. Spirit wants to speak to you. You will hear them because they will just, there's no way when spirit speaks to you that you cannot hear it. So you never need be afraid that you're missing a message from spirit. If they want to talk to you, they will, right? Uh-huh. And if they're not talking to you, it's because they don't need to at this point in time. You're doing fine. Just carry on.
Okay. Then you're saying that some of us are guided by, quote unquote, the spirit from the other side who guides us and is with us all the time. Is that what you
are
inferring?
Yes, we all do.
Is that right?
You know, most people like to think of them as guardian angels. The word angel means messenger, right?
Uh-huh.
And
uh-huh.
So a guardian angel is a good way to think. Every soul has a counterpart in spirit that is watching out for it. And interestingly enough, as you develop, you don't necessarily have the same guardian as an adult that you had as a child. The guardianship of souls is done by those who are volunteering on the other side to take on that role after they've died. And so they are, if they themselves are not spiritually very knowledgeable, right, then they may are just looking out for some kids or something. But once you get to the stage where you are asking the right questions, then you get a guide with more knowledge who can be a teacher for you. And as you grow, your teachers also evolve. You get higher and higher teachers. But it's not all one size fits all in spirit. It's just like a great university. You learn, and as you progress, you get more qualified teachers to teach you more qualified things. It's an endless, endless process. I don't think it ever ends. I think it just goes spiraling onward and upward forever. I have never known an end to infinity.
Right. Because, I just want to take a minute here. You say you have been incarnated on this planet at least 5, 6, 7 times? Yes?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. You don't remember all the times that you have been here? Yes?
No. Well,
okay.
I don't know if I've been here that... I remember many times, right?
Uh-huh.
And if I've been here more times than that and I don't remember, well, then I just don't remember. They're not in my memory banks. Let's put it that way.
So we have 9 billion people on this planet. You were saying that they have been here before, many of them, not maybe all, but mm-hmm. many of them have been here before. Is that what you're saying? Even
I
me,
say
you're saying I
Yes. Oh, I know you have. I know you have. I would say that right now, and this is just my personal assessment of what I see, right? I think that we have probably 1/3 of the global population, roughly, are souls that originated in other planetary systems and have incarnated on Earth at this particular time in history because we are coming to the end of a great cycle for the human species and things are in flux. Things are going to change in the universe. So that's one third. And they simply come here to experience that change because of the intensity of it on Earth. Right? I think that probably the other third, another third of the people on this planet have been on Earth reincarnating many, many times and did originate from some other part of the universe, but have been here so long they've probably forgotten where they came from. And then the last third of the people on the planet, I think, are the true Earth humans that actually began their soul's experiences on planet Earth thousands of years ago, millions of years ago. But their soul's home, you might say, is planet Earth. And I think that's probably not more than a third of the population of the planet. The rest are all from other places.
Yeah. It's hard to get that picture because we weren't taught that in the church or the school systems, that we have been here before, that we are soul energy coming to this planet to continue to learn what we have to learn so that we can ascend. That's right. But only a few people really understood that. I mean, they just don't teach that. Did you go to school where they taught that?
No, I went to school, to high school in the old days when you had scripture classes and studied the Bible. And it was a regular government high school I went to in England, but we had scripture classes in those days.
Right.
So no, so, I didn't. Nobody ever talked to me about those things. Not in school.
What we have been taught up to this point is in conflict to our real soul's energy or travels that we need to take, right?
Mostly,
it is. Mostly. Yeah, William Tompkins talked about that, remember? He said we were taught all wrong.
The Roman Catholic Church actually taught reincarnation for the first, I think, 300 or 400 years. And reincarnation is actually in the Bible. There are places where they reference people coming back, like, you know, this is Isaiah has returned to us. In other words, for the people who were writing or speaking in the Bible, reincarnation was taken for granted with them, that people or soul energies of people could come back again into another life on the planet. So it was just one of the councils of the Roman Catholic Church, and the reason for taking it out and no longer allowing anyone in the Roman Catholic religion to believe in reincarnation was simply the fact that if you understand you have life after life after life and there's no end to it, right, you're going to be much harder to discipline when they say to you, oh, you know, you have to endure and do as we tell you. You will see there's no reason for you to do as they tell you, that you're better off searching out things out for yourself and moving yourself forward so next time you have a better life than you're having this time, regardless of what that life is. So it was a manipulation on the part of the religions of the world to take out reincarnation. And, of course, the Hindu religion and the Buddhist philosophy absolutely include reincarnation.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the manipulation of the Gospels back in Constantine. Talk about how that was done a few years ago, that they took out the Book of Enoch and they threw out Essenes, what they were talking about. You got that history.
Right.
Talk about that for us.
It wasn't so much that they took them out of the Bible, as the word Bible, as you know, simply means a composite of multiple stories. That's the word Bible means. When you put a whole bunch of separate stories together in one place. And so that's what the Bible is. It's a multiplicity of stories from different sources, all put together in one book. And the Old Testament, the Torah, is the Jewish history, the history of the Jewish people. and contains, the Torah itself contains, I believe, five books, and then there are additional books. All of the books in the Old Testament can be questioned because they are history books. In fact, some years ago, about 20, 30 years ago, a group of Jewish scholars in Israel, who I forget what kind of rabbis they are, but all they do is study the Torah. And they came to the conclusion that the book of Job, which is very often used by ministers in churches as a teaching book because of, you know, Job was faithful to the Lord even when he took everything away, that whole thing, trying to tell you, you know, if you lose everything, it doesn't matter. You should still love God, right? That book of Job, they came to the conclusion, was a fabricated story and there was no truth in it whatsoever. And they actually published a public statement to that effect at the time. This is many years ago, at least 20, 30, 40 years ago, maybe. So that's an interesting thought, that the rabbis themselves are questioning constantly what is in the books that they believe in. The New Testament, along with the rest of the Bible, has, of course, been retranslated several times, not just once, but many, many, many times. If, for example, you read the Geneva Bible, which is the one that the pilgrims had when they came to America, the verses of the New Testament in the Geneva Bible, many of them read quite differently to the King James Bible, which is the one that I have. I have the King James version of the Bible. I'm not just saying a word or two here and there mistranslated or changed. I'm talking about the whole meaning of the actual thing that it says being changed so that it means something quite different. And this has happened largely because at different times in history, the powers that be have decided to bring the Bible up to date and to put it into more modern language. And so you get a completely different meaning out of what is said. And really and truly, if you wanted to know what the Bible said, you would have to go to the earliest writings that you could find, you know, like the Dead Sea Scrolls, and be able to read ancient Hebrew, these kinds of things, to get back to what was originally said. And there are, in fact, some writings from those times, from the Dead Sea Scrolls and the teachings of the Essenes, which were, of course, before Christ, contain Christ's message. The teachings of the Essenes are the messages that the Christ taught. He taught the philosophy of Buddhism, the seven pillars of wisdom, as a process. He taught the process of spiritual growth in the same way as Buddhism teaches it. And he taught the stories and parables about how to live in the same way that the Essenes taught it. You would find those, some of the things are absolutely verbatim. You know, they're the same language used in both things and the New Testament. But what the churches did at the councils, both Nicaea and Constantinople, they decided which of all the ancient scrolls, writings, gospels — a gospel is a letter, by the way, or an epistle. Epistle is a letter, a gospel is a story written down, right? And they went through them all, hundreds of them, not just four gospels, four letters, stories, no, dozens of the things. And they went through them, and they had already decided what they were going to teach as, this is the Christian religion, this is what it says. And so they then chose the writings which supported the way they wanted to run the church, and they discarded everything else. Now, the most interesting thing to me about those decisions was not that they were choosing what supported their own ideas, of the inner group, the cabal running things, but that most of the bishops who were voting at that time to decide which should constitute the New Testament and which should not, could neither read nor write. They were ignorant people. Reading and writing was still a great rarity. And even though these men, many of them had been made bishops, and there were over 300 of them at the conference that decided on what would be in, the vast majority of them, I think it was 260 some of them, and you'd have to check me on that because I'm not sure, but it was a huge number, like two-thirds of them, could neither read nor write. And yet they were deciding what would constitute in writing the New Testament. And so there was a great deal of malarkey went on in choosing that. It does not include everything, the Gospel of Thomas, the Book of Enoch, many, many other wonderful writings out there that were not included, that were thrown out. And a great deal was lost in the teachings of Christ. But we also need to remember that there is nothing to guarantee that what is taught by the Christian church or was put into their teachings 600 years after Christ, like 300 and some one council, 400 and some another, when they were making these decisions, all these hundreds of years after his ministry, almost everything that was decided was based on not knowledge of what Christ said. St. Paul had decided. You remember, he's the guy who was called Saul and had the awakening on the road to Damascus, and suddenly he became the authority on Christ. Didn't know him, never met him, never heard from him, but he suddenly saw the light, and he absolutely designed the Christian religion. So it really isn't Christian, it's Pauline. We would be more honest if we said it's a Pauline religion, because he's the one who structured it. Now, if you want to know what Christ was talking about, then go farther back to the first 100 years after his ministry and read the translations and the stories of the Desert Fathers. These were the hermits that lived in the desert in Egypt, predominantly Egypt, but they lived out in the desert. They were hermits, and they spent their lives praying and studying the words of Christ that had been passed to them. And they tell stories about what it meant to them, how they understood what Christ was teaching. And you will find that that will also correlate in a much more intellectual way in the book Saving Jesus, which actually goes all the way back to the beginning. And the author of that book, Saving Jesus, is actually extremely well qualified, because as an aide to the Pope for many, many years, he had access to all the archives that are hidden away under the Vatican with all the most ancient writings and teachings and information. There, as far as, you know, I am aware, there may even be notes that Christ himself wrote to somebody. I don't know what they've got hidden away there. I know they have a huge library. And the man who wrote that book, Saving Jesus, for years had access to all that information, which is phenomenal.
So what was his coming to Jesus moment, if I may say it that way, when he wrote Saving Jesus? What did he change prior to what he was believing and studying as he was working with the higher-ups in the Catholic Church?
Well, because he changed his whole understanding, because he, like the rest of us who consider ourselves to be raised as in the Christian faith, we were all taught, and we have been taught as humanity for 2,000 years, and this is something that I didn't get until I read that book, that I might have a different understanding now. As I was reading that book, Saving Jesus, I'm saying, because it was all I understood it already. Before I read it, I understood it, right? So I'm going through it and I'm saying, yes, I agree with this. Yes, I agree with this. Yes, I understand this. Yes, this is what I think as well. Right. It wasn't until I got to the end of it and realized what he was doing that I came to the realization that despite my understanding right now in this time being truly on track with the reality and the truth of Christ and what he was doing, I too, like everybody else, had 2,000 years of multiple incarnations on this planet in a Christian world. I was actually 3 times in convents, twice in Benedictine convents and 1 time in a Carmelite convent through different incarnations. So talk about being brainwashed with the Christian belief. And the Christian belief, which was decided by the bishops, was all centered around the crucifixion. Christ died for you, and only if you believe that, if only you believe that he died for you and that that saves you, will you be saved. So all you have to do is believe, okay, this man was murdered in my name and now I'm saved. Well, that's actually not correct. That's not what Christ was about at all. And it's a whole different understanding that you get, because Christ was here not to die for us, but to live for us and to teach us and to teach us how to master death. That was his function. That's why he came, to show you how to develop yourself where you can one day become like him, a multidimensional being who can step into time and create yourself a body without having to be reincarnated and born every time. You can step down to the planet, any planet, and you can do some work to help the rest of the people at that time, and you can leave again at will when you choose to do it. And this is what Christ did. He came to the planet. He showed you that even when they tried to kill him, he could master death and come back and sit down and have supper with his disciples after a few days, after he'd ascended to heaven and gone through a radioactive change, right?
Right.
And so
right.
We are so brainwashed historically that even all those who think like me and understand that the message of Christ was a teaching message, not a dying message, right? We still, in our inner core, at subconscious level, have been brainwashed in all those previous lives to believe what the church taught us. And as soon as I realized that, it was like an explosion inside me. I suddenly, yes, I can see it. Now I can understand. That's what's held me back from a total understanding of how to move forward. And the interesting thing in my experience was, after I read that book a couple of times and really got the message, it had just exploded like a light bulb on me, that understanding. And I started trying to put into practice the techniques that are also in there. And I'm walking around on my morning walk, thinking all this stuff and talking to the guys as I'm walking along. And I said, I understand this, but I'm not having much success with actually doing it. I'm not manifesting anything. I'm not producing it. And they came right back at me and they said very clearly, don't worry, Jillian. You don't have to be able to do it at this time. It is sufficient that you understand it. So that is the message I would like to pass out to anybody else who is willing to read that book, to move themselves forward and get that understanding that if you just can understand it, it doesn't matter whether you can actually do it or not, because what it means is that in your next go around, you will be able to do it. You could make this your last lifetime. This could become your last lifetime. You won't need to do it again.
All right.
It's
an amazing book. I think I want to end the program today just on that note, because we talked about a variety of subject matters. I didn't want to mix it all up today, but I wanted to talk about that one book, Saving Jesus, which you say will help us advance our soul consciousness for ascension, if we're following that.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that's a good message to leave with the people, really. And next time we can go into other things, but I just wanted to be right on target about what that book was about and how we can, for those people who are ready to listen and follow, as he had to do, you're saying saving Jesus is the answer, right?
Yes, definitely. Okay. It's a wonderful book.
Great, great.
And thank you for giving it so much exposure. And there is a website. They also has a website, I understand, and people could go to that website, I'm sure, and get much more information.
And then I need the correct spelling of his name, because
Michael Ledwith. It's an odd sort of spelling. It's MICEAL, and then Ledwith, LEDWITH.
All right.
Michael
Great.
Ledwith.
Okay. Well, I think that's a good message for the day. And it's from the Forbidden Truth series, and it's about 600 pages, but it's well worth it. I've talked to people who have ordered it since you've been talking about it, and I just wanted to concentrate on that, because you're saying the number one reason we are on this planet at this time is to advance our consciousness and develop our soul's energy, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So I'm going to turn in my yacht and my Bentley and my $100 million house, and I'm going to concentrate on developing my soul. Is that okay?
Well, no, I wouldn't do that if I was you. I would go on a nice cruise on the yacht to the Caribbean and meditate all the way.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you being here. Until next time, Jillian Green.
Okay.
And, okay,
bye.
Have a good one now.
Bye-bye,
okay,
Russell.
Take care of yourself.
Bye-bye.
In the quiet crucible of our personal, private sufferings that our noblest dreams are born and our greatest gifts are given, and often given in compensation for what we've been through. It is in the quiet crucible of our personal, private sufferings that our noblest dreams are born and our greatest gifts are given, and often given in compensation for what we have been through.